Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Scarlet Leadership Institute monthly lunch and leadership call. If you'd like a copy of today's slides or you'd like to share a replay of today's call, you can go to our website tomorrow. We will have that posted. You can download the slides and listen to the call. And during the call, if you have a question, hit *7. And if you're watching online, you can enter your question in the Q&A box and hit send. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to the world-famous Joe Scarlet.
Hey. Again, welcome, everybody, to our monthly Lunch and Learn call. We've been doing this for 4 or 5 years now, and today a press release went out announcing a merger with the Scarlet Leadership Institute with the Work Institute here in Nashville. There'll be a website. The press release will be posted on our website a little bit later today. You can read all about it. The important thing from your perspective today is that the calls will continue. Our next call will be on Tuesday, May 9th. And on that date, our guest will be Danny Nelms, who is the president of the Work Institute. And he's going to talk about employee engagement and evidence-based decision-making. He's got a lot of great stories about how best to retain employees, and that's something that's of great interest to all of us in leadership roles. To carry on, I'd like to turn it over to our hostess, Mary Fink. Mary?
Thank you, Joe. We are excited to have with us today Andrew Johnston. Andrew is a consultant, a coach, a teacher, has had many careers, has done many things in higher education, and is a great instructor. We have him come for several of our classes here at the Scarlet Leadership Institute, and he is always one of the students' favorites. So today's topic, at popular request, is managing conflict. He talks about conflict and having difficult conversations and how to minimize the fear and the threat and intimidation of a difficult conversation by minimizing some of the emotion. But also just how to really get into managing conflict. Well-managed conflict is a plus, not a minus, and he's going to talk a little bit about that. So welcome, Andrew.
Thanks. I feel like you didn't mention a couple of my most important credentials, though, since this crosses professional and personal lines. In addition to those other things, I've actually been married for 30 years to the same woman, and I have raised two kids to their teenage years, and those sometimes have been the lab for how to manage conflict.
Conflict,
well,
there you go.
It needs to be out there, too.
There you go. That's probably exactly true. So we talk about conflict that is well managed as a good thing, not a bad thing. Say a little bit about that.
Yeah, I find that when I'm interacting with people about conflict, it's not their favorite topic necessarily. They approach it looking for some way that they can sort of weather it. There's like a group of people that really don't want to have conflict in their life, and they're hoping that in some way I can offer them some thoughts on how they can avoid it and have as little as possible. And then there's some that I think recognize they're never going to escape it, so they're kind of figuring it's a necessary evil. Maybe there's some information that will help them kind of hunker down and take it.
And then we have some carriers.
Yeah, there may be.
There. Create the conflict.
Yeah, there may be. There may be carriers. But, you know, candidly, my goal is always to move people all the way to the end of the spectrum where they start to think of conflict as actually something positive that leads them in the directions of the things that they want most in their relationships and their collaboration, so that, you know, maybe instead of avoiding it or hunkering down, they might have the inclination to step into it.
Right.
We've all had experiences with negative conflict, things that have harmed relationships or performance or our satisfaction, and I think sometimes those things have been so potent for us that it's caused us to decide it's best if we try to stay away from it altogether, and we might forget or overlook the fact that conflict is actually prerequisite to the greatest relationships we have in our life. They're the key to exceptional performance and even our personal fulfillment when we handle it well.
Any personal experience?
One or two. Well, I would just say this, that I think of the relationships, for instance, that mean the most to me, that I rely on. I jokingly referenced my wife and my kids earlier. But sometimes I summarize the positive effect of conflict in these situations and say all the good stuff lies through conflict, not around it. And the reason I say that is because it's easy to think of conflict as an impediment to what you really want. and that if you avoid it, maybe you'll get to what you want more easily. But that turns out not to be true, because so many of the things that you want are created in the process of conflict or tension. And so, for instance, in those relationships I mentioned that mean so much to me, those are the relationships I trust most. And I'd imagine that you have relationships like that in your life, too. And if you think of the person that you trust most, that you rely on and you know is sure and certain beyond anything, I suspect that it's not because you've never had a cross word mm-hmm. with one another, but mm-hmm. probably precisely because you've been through some stuff together.
Right.
And that's the process by which you temper and strengthen the relationship and the trust you have for one another.
You know, I think about some of the times when I was traveling to stores and we get into debates about should we carry this product or that product or the next product, and you do the most learning when you have different ideas coming at you and somebody's arguing in favor of this and somebody's arguing in favor of something else. You learn through those environments, and you also, I think, develop relationships and develop confidence in other people by going through the process of arguing and disagreeing and usually reaching an agreement in the end.
Yeah. Well, and I think you mentioned in the process of doing these things, and I think that's important to recognize that relationships just don't come out of the box preassembled. Decisions don't just pop out of the air. I don't know. At least in my experience, we don't naturally trust people, collaborate well, and all these sorts of things. It takes a process. And so conflict is really the vital part of that. I mean, let me give you a scenario for those sorts of things that you go through. It's easy to remember, but all of our relationships, the groups we're part of, those sorts of things start out in what we might call the forming stage. It's just the very beginning, and our interactions at that point are usually pretty cautious and protected while we're guarding ourselves and getting the lay of the land. And if that went on for a long time with no change, we probably wouldn't be too satisfied. Sometimes I think of it as a first date. If you characterize your interactions on a first date, they're pretty shallow. And that's not going to really be satisfactory to you for a long time. If you're on your 10th date and it's still shallow and careful, you're going to feel like it's not going anywhere, and eventually you're going to have to do something. And groups are like that, too. At some point, somebody gets tired of being safe and they get real. And that's when some conflict enters the game. We call that moving from the forming stage to the storming stage. And I don't mean that it's a knockdown, drag-out fight, but this is the point where people get real. They have opinions. They might even have an opinion about someone else's opinion. And if they get through this storming stage with conflict involved, all the good stuff happens, because we get to the norming stage where they start knowing what they expect of each other. They know how they'll make decisions, what they can do to contribute, what they can expect from others to contribute. And if they get that taken care of, that's when they really start performing. So it's this process of going from forming through storming to norming and performing. And if we back away from conflict when we see it coming, what we're really doing is backing up into that sort of hell of the perpetual first date. And we don't get that strength and that performance. We don't make those good decisions or have those relationships because we avoided the very experience, the friction, tension, disagreement sometimes, but the experience in which we produce them.
I think that's true. And I know part of your course that you teach, you talk a little bit about the five dysfunctions and the fact that conflict is one of those dysfunctions. And what Lencioni is talking about there is vulnerability-based conflict, where it's okay for me to let you know what I don't know. It's okay for me to expose my weakness. And you can't do that at the very beginning. You have to be together long enough to feel safe to do that.
Oh, yeah.
But that's when you're really, when the rubber really meets the road.
Oh, absolutely. Pat's term for this is that if you fear conflict in a relationship or a collaborative relationship like a team, you start trying to preserve artificial harmony
right.
at all cost. I mean, that's such a powerful term, right? That is that hell of the perpetual first date where it's not even real harmony. It's pretend. I interact with leaders all the time that will tell me this phrase. Maybe you've heard it. It's, I trust everyone until they give me a reason not to. And I think that sounds pretty cool. It's, you hear the music rising in the background. This is from the, Hallmark Movie Channel or something like that.
Right.
And it's laudable. I think they genuinely want to believe that, but it's just not the way trust works. Trust is something that has to be built, and it's built like anything's built, just brick by brick, piece by piece. What that means in relationships is that you extend yourself. That vulnerability you mentioned. Mm-hmm. You take a little risk and expose yourself a little bit, and you find that it was okay. So you're inclined to put it out there a little more, and you find out that that's okay. Or, you know, believe it or not, you might even put it out there and find that it's betrayed. But if you work through that again, that's an even stronger contribution to trust. And slowly but surely, you build that trust. Now, if you're not willing to have any friction or conflict, or the moment you sense the potential of that, you sort of batten down the hatches and hide all the good stuff.
Right.
There's no way that you build that kind of trust.
Right.
And artificial harmony is your only recourse.
Or you run away.
Oh, yeah.
Or you just leave the relationship and you wonder how many people could have had a great relationship if only they were in there.
Yeah, wouldn't it be shocking to discover that we don't really want to be safe? That safety is actually a pretty lonely spot, and what we want really lies on the other side of conflict.
Yeah. Safety is actually pretty boring.
Yeah, it can be. Yeah.
I like to encourage conflict because that's where good ideas come from. You learn when Charlie says one thing and Mary says something else, and you toss your ideas around and you disagree and you disagree, but you probably come up with a good solution.
Yeah.
And by working together, everybody gets to know each other. You develop better relationships and you make better decisions.
Oh,
well, if somebody comes to you and is really honest about something maybe that you've said that they disagree with or that they think didn't go the way it should have gone. I mean, think about the relationships that you've had with people that will come in and tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Those are the people that you really valued.
I always encourage that kind of thing. And the one thing you always got to remember, if somebody's going to come in and deliver you bad news, the only thing you got to say is thank you for telling
me.
Exactly. Start arguing
with
them. Exactly. But I had a gal I worked with, a tractor supply company, for years, and she, if I did something crazy and she was, she'd come see me later on. She'd say, Joe, do you realize what you just said this morning at the meeting, or do you realize the impact you had in doing such and such? And of course I didn't. And when I found out, I could go back and try to make amends for screwing things up, which was you. Those are great relationships to have.
Oh, don't you? Yeah, don't you love the fact that she had the courage to do that? Right. You know, and I love what you said that it.
And I thanked her for it. Every time she did, I said, "Thank you for telling me about it."
Absolutely. Yeah, because you want some more of it.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Well, and when you said that it helps us make good decisions, you know, if we're conflict averse, if we're not really willing to storm a little bit, just have some friction or some opinions, it makes us really vulnerable to bad decisions, bad decision making. Mm-hmm. We typically employ a sort of, I guess I'd call it ideological Darwinism, this sort of survival of the fittest method to figure out what a good idea is, in that we'll throw it out on the table. And then we'll all beat it up. And if it survives, then we know this is a good idea and we'll move forward to implement it. We'll put big resources, time, and attention behind it and all. But what would happen if you don't beat it up? I mean, you may have even been in that situation before.
Everybody nods around the table.
Yeah.
Well,
this is an example I sometimes share with people. I'll share it with you, is that I came into a situation one time where I went from a position at one university where I was sort of in the middle of the org chart to a position at another university where I was at the top of the org chart. And as I stepped into that role, I recognized that there was a meeting already on the books for 2 weeks later that we'd be discussing a big retreat that we were having to plan, and that meant that we were going to have a big brainstorming meeting. And I was pretty excited about this because I'd always been the idea guy. And I thought, this is great. I'm going to take this new job, and then I'm going to get to go really show my stuff. My team's going to be so happy that I'm their new boss. Well, sure enough, we go on this retreat, and we start this brainstorming session. Someone throws out an idea, and people kind of nod, and another person throws out a different idea, and they throw out another idea. We get several of them on the table, and then I throw out an idea. And the strangest thing happened. The team stopped what it was doing. It wrote the idea down, and the entire conversation pivoted to talk about implementing what I'd just thrown out there.
One of the things I learned early on in business is when you're the boss, you need to be the last one to put your idea on the table.
Yeah.
Because so often what happens, you put your idea out there, and everybody says, oh, yes, boss, that was right. And that's the absolute worst thing you want to do as a leader, because then people are going to line up and do whatever you tell them to do, and therefore you're not going to get the best ideas. You're not going to get the best thinking. And no matter what you all think, bosses, usually your ideas are not the best. Usually the best ideas are somewhere else in the group.
Well, where were you when I needed you? That's exactly what you Well, and that really worried me. I mean, I viewed this as a big problem, although I'll admit there's been a few times I've shared this example. Recently I was sharing it with a group of executives, and I said, you know, I really had this problem because I threw out an idea and everybody wrote it down and started talking about implementing it. And one of the members in the group looked at me and said, boy, I wish I had that problem. But the reason it's a problem is, frankly, similar to the example you gave, Joe, is, you know, I say some crazy things. I have some.
Sometimes you just throw something out.
I just was trying to play along, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
And if your team or your partners that you work with don't recognize that this is a good thing, the kind of conflict that allows you to contend about ideas, then you're really vulnerable to your crazy ideas, and you're liable to run off and implement something that's way too expensive, causes too many problems. Or another thing that frequently happens is something that we call groupthink, where everybody seems to be saluting. The kind of colloquial definition of groupthink that I always remember is it's the phenomenon that makes all of us together support something that none of us individually endorse.
Exactly.
I know that sounds like nonsensical when you say it out loud, but when you're experiencing it in a team, it's hard to recognize, and it leads you into some horrible spots.
It's managing agreement rather than managing conflict.
Great, yeah, great distinction.
And sometimes it's way harder because the group is not used to it for whatever reason, as a new leader, or it's something we've done in the past. But I mean, it's amazing how difficult that can be.
Oh yeah, well, and to be perfectly honest, it's something that many of us think we're immune to because we are very intelligent, or we have done our homework, or we really care greatly about the outcome. And, you know, research and experience tells us that none of those things will save you. In fact, some research suggests that the more intelligent the participants in a group are, the more subject they are to this kind of group thinking.
Exactly.
And so really the only thing that inoculates you against groupthink is your willingness to have conflict.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. I want to move us along in the interest of time, and I want to talk about, because it's spot on about difficult conversations, and that's adopting the right posture. There are some mind shifts that we think are important in order to have good, difficult conversations, minimize emotion, be as prepared as we can mentally as well as every other way. So talk a little bit about those three shifts.
I guess there are a variety of kind of unexpected or maybe counterintuitive postures that you might adopt. We all fall into sort of a routine of how we address these things. I don't know where we get that, to tell you the truth. I think that's something that's more caught than taught, is that somewhere in our lives, you know, we've watched other people, maybe in our families or our friends, and it kind of taught us how to respond. But sometimes that doesn't tell us to do the right things in a given moment. So some of the ones that I frequently highlight is the first one is to try to shift your perspective from certainty to curiosity. Particularly if you think of conflict in the context of a difficult conversation that you need to have.
I'm right and you're wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's exactly the way I approach it, right?
Exactly.
The typical difficult conversation for me is when I'm anticipating I need to go and get somebody's mind right. You know, I know what the situation is, and now I need to go and get them clear on the way it is. The challenge is that, you know, reality is overrated. The way it is not as unnegotiable as you think it is. I know this is crazy, but I've done this with enough groups that even here on a conference call, I'll try this, and I'm just going to imagine all of you out there doing that. I'm going to try to get the people here at the table to do it. But if you take your finger and you point it up at the ceiling, kind of hold your hand above your head, and you rotate it clockwise. Okay, you got that going? Now, just slowly keep it going and lower it down in front of your face. Keep it going down below your chin. Keep it going down to where now it's down near your waist and still going. Now, look down on it and tell me what direction is it going?
I don't know what direction.
It's fun. It's fun for me to imagine you all, but it may be even more fun for you to imagine the people around the table here doing this. When you start, obviously, it's going counterclockwise, like I asked for you to do it. But by the time I ask you to look at the end, it's going clockwise. And I always have fun doing this. If you do it in a group, you may realize that 10 or 15 minutes later, there's still somebody in the corner of the room kind of trying it, figuring out,
like
know,
me.
What on earth happened? Yeah, Joe is here doing that right now. He's thinking, when did my finger leave my hand? Here, it's a silly example, but it works with third graders or 30-year-olds or anyone else. The point is, nothing ever stopped. You didn't reverse directions. It was simply you viewed it from a different vantage point. And I love this simple example because it's not that it looked a little different.
Uh-huh.
It looked completely opposite because of the perspective that you viewed it from. And when we talk about shifting from certainty to curiosity, in part that's slowing your roll to say, let me think about this and kind of move the camera on the situation to imagine how could somebody else that cares similarly, that's similarly intelligent and all, how could they view this differently? Do they have access to data or information that might cause them to understand this differently, et cetera? And really trying to enter this conversation and get all those things on the table rather than to shut them down.
Right.
So that's that first posture.
Yeah. Where have we come from? Different places.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So we all have different perspectives.
Yeah. The second one I often share with people is to try to separate impact from intent. Just try to do this. I mean, what we experience in life is we normally experience the impact of other people's actions, and then we make assumptions about the intention that was behind that.
Right.
It turns out that human beings are really lousy at interpreting intentions.
Mm-hmm.
It's so commonly problematic that in research we have a word for it. We call it the fundamental attribution error. And what that basically means is that we accord circumstances a lot more of a role in our behavior than in somebody else's.
Yeah. They're a bad person. I just had a bad situation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me give you an example of that double standard in case you think you're above it. If sometime after this call today you hop in your car and you've been very busy and had a lot of things on your mind, you even skipped your lunch break to take this conference call, so you're going to drive on this errand, and you're driving down the road and you realize with all this on your mind you're about to pass your exit. And so you check your mirror and quickly cut across the two lanes beside you and get your exit. That's you can appreciate that. That's something you might do. But let me change your perspective and say, what if at the end of the day you're headed home and you're driving down the highway and all of a sudden somebody two lanes on the left of you swerves across your lane to catch the exit? What's the first thing you think about them?
Idiot.
Yeah.
What an idiot.
There's the double standard,
exactly.
Right? Well, when we have that double standard, we tangle up impacts and intentions. It's not that we don't have to deal with both of them, but when we tangle them up together and we try to talk to somebody about the impact of their actions, they often feel like we're impugning their character or their intentions. They respond to defend themselves against that, and we hear them denying that there was any impact. And so we come back at them again to drive home our point, and we get lost in this sort of ugly dance that devolves into interpersonal bickering.
Right.
I just realized there are lots of people who think I'm an idiot.
Do you do a lot of swerving across lanes?
Well, you know what we say about that, if the shoe fits. Okay, moving on to shifting from blame and to joint contribution. And I personally think this is subtle but so important.
Yeah.
It puts you in a whole different place.
Yeah, and shockingly, these words matter.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Our, the posture is to shift from blame to contribution. When we blame somebody, it's not productive, but it's not unproductive because it's mean or ugly. it's unproductive because it doesn't lead us to solutions we might see otherwise.
Right.
If we thought more broadly about everything involved in the situation, and instead of thinking who's to blame, we thought, what am I contributing? What are they contributing to the situation? It leads us to other options. I'll give you an example from my own life. When I was first married, I took a new job, and I was trying to prove myself in this new job. It was in a university, so I was working as the director of student activities, and I was working on a student schedule, which is no schedule at all. So I was gone a lot from my new bride. I was absent. Well, this caused my wife to be frustrated and feel like she was being neglected, understandably, and it caused her to be angry. And so as this continued over time, my wife was angry and because I was absent, and I was absent, frankly, because my wife was angry, and we got kind of locked in this cycle, right? This was a bad cycle that was leading towards real estrangement in our relationship. And if you'd asked my wife back then, what's to blame for the issues in your relationship, she would have said, my absent husband. And if you'd asked me what's to blame, I would have said, my angry wife. And that, there might be a truth in that, but it's such a partial truth. That's the language of blame, and it only led us to these solutions, right? If you ask my wife what needs to change, she'd say, my husband needs to be around more. Well, what are her chances of changing me? Pretty slim, right? Or maybe you'd have asked me what needs to change, and I would have said, my wife needs to get happy. Well, what are my chances of changing my wife? Well, again, not so good, so that wasn't going to change anything. That's where blame leads us. But if you think in terms of contribution, it's a totally different. If you'd asked my wife what's contributing to this, she would have said, well, my absent husband and the fact that I'm angry. I would have said, well, my wife's angry and the fact that I'm gone.
Right.
That leads me to another option. I could change my own behavior and affect this, or my wife could change her own behavior. And in truth, that's what we did. So we stopped that cycle and all. And that's why we encourage people when they step into conflict to try to drive that linear cause and effect perspective that comes with blame out of the conversation and instead invite people to discuss what's contributing to this. If you want to practice this, I'd even say the real courage lies in discussing what's contributing to this and you ante up first.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I like to think of it as blame one against another. And joint contribution is the two of us on the same side of the table trying to solve a problem.
That's a great image, yeah.
So.
Yeah, it transforms something that could be combat into something that looks a lot more like mutual problems.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, I want us to get to the responses to conflict, so we're going to go there for a few minutes. There are five, and when you were talking earlier about how sometimes we don't engage in conflict and we create problems there are times when avoiding is just the right thing.
Sure.
But it's a matter of knowing what those times are. So talk to us a little bit about these styles.
Yeah. Well, I'll try to do this briefly. There's so much to this. But let me start out by encouraging all of us to have a repertoire of responses mm-hmm. to conflict. I think sometimes we fall prey to the idea that there's a best response to conflict that we should employ all the time, and that doesn't work. If you only have one tool in your toolbox, you can't do what's necessary. Have you ever heard the adage that to a child with a hammer, everything's a nail, right? Well, I think we experience that sometimes in the way we respond, that we may encounter a situation that we need to address, and we have this way that we respond to conflict. It's served us pretty well through our careers. That's why we're leaders. Yeah, we're comfortable. So when we walk into conflict, we grab for that tool, and it may not be well suited to the situation, so it may not serve you well. Thomas Kilman is a researcher that's done a lot of work on conflict styles, and he really describes the possible kinds of responses in terms of essentially two priorities. Think of them like radio dials. You can turn up or down independently of each other. One of them is your assertiveness. In other words, how much you're going to prioritize what you think is best or your own agenda. And the other one is your cooperativeness. But it's how much you're going to prioritize what the other person thinks is best, or maybe the relationship itself. And so by dialing those up or down, you really can kind of frame five different responses on this. I'll try to talk about them real quickly here. You could be competing. Competing is a situation where you've turned your assertiveness dial all the way up and you've turned your cooperativeness dial down. So in other words, what you think is best or what you think is the right answer is more important than everything else. You're willing to subordinate the other person's views in relationship to that.
My way or the highway.
Absolutely. In fact, sometimes we call it the win-lose position because you're going to win this if you're competing. Now, there are times that's really important. There are times when there's a moral issue on the line, maybe a compliance issue or a safety issue on the line that you need to hold that line. There's no negotiation about this or anything else, so you need to be able to compete. If that's not in your repertoire, you may find yourself getting wishy-washy when the situation or your team needs you to be firm. But think for a moment, what would it be like if the people working with you get a steady diet of competing and that's the only response in your repertoire? Well, that doesn't work well. That eventually harms your team because if it's a win-lose situation, people get tired of losing and then they just don't play.
Yeah, it's a win-lose situation and you're always winning.
Absolutely.
But either because of position or you just beat them down or whatever.
Yeah. And you can appreciate that. Maybe you've even been in a situation like that. It lingers if you've experienced that.
People leave. They don't want to work for bosses like that.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. Well, they don't come back, Joe, like the situation you said earlier where you had someone that was willing to come and give you candid feedback, and that doesn't happen if they've gotten a steady diet of competing. They decide, well, you can fend for yourself. So if we go to the other side of that spectrum, and in this case we've turned the cooperative dial all the way up and the assertiveness dial down, we're talking about accommodating. This is a situation where the most important thing to you is the relationship. You're willing to even subordinate what you think is best in the interest of the other person's agenda. Now this is really important anytime you need to maintain a relationship. For instance, if in a customer service situation, you need to have somebody that's able to accommodate because if you put a competitor in charge of your customer service, you're not going to have customers very long. The old adage.
I've met that guy.
You have. The old adage, the customer is always right. You know, we know that's not true, and competitors would spend all their time clarifying that fact. But accommodators recognize that, you know, even though I know what's right or I know that this person is wrong, I'm going to make some concessions because it's not just about this interaction, it's about the future ones, and I want the relationship to continue.
We're about two-thirds of the way through the call now, and we'd like to, you know, you got the question and answer box on your screen there. If you'd like to send us in some hypothetical situations for us to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. So just you can do that, or you can hit *7 and talk to us directly.
Go ahead.
Well, there's only a couple other spots on here. If we look at where you've turned the assertiveness dial all the way down and you've turned the cooperativeness dial all the way down, we're at what you might call avoiding. And it's interesting. People often do feel like, you know, this is like a cowardly response, and that shouldn't be in your repertoire. But if you've ever followed a leader that lacks the ability to avoid conflict, you can appreciate why this should be in people's repertoire. If you're going to compete all the time, you might get away with that in your own life, but when others are following you, you need to know when to avoid conflict. One of the perfect times to avoid conflict is when you know you've lost already. You know, early in my career, I was more of a competitor. I knew that not every hill was a hill to die on. I just thought it was peculiar that I'd never come across that hill yet. You know? And if that's the case, you feel like it's the principle of the thing, and you're willing to be a martyr for whatever cause. And I suppose there are some things like that, some moral absolutes that, you know, it's important to charge up that hill even though you know you've lost. But if you're responsible for people and programs that are following you up the hill, you need to know that it's time to back away if you've already lost. If there's not enough to be gained, or it's unlikely you will win anything, you need to be able to avoid conflict. Another really useful time to avoid things is when you're choosing the time for the conflict, too, because you may not want to have the conversation right now. And so you avoid it now and come back and maybe exemplify one of these other responses later when you deal with it.
Or maybe you know something that's coming down the pike that the other party doesn't know.
Ah,
the time
point.
To just back off and let it happen.
Yeah, and you know that it's coming and it may inform this. In fact, you know that it may cause the conflict to really just magically dissipate if you just pause.
Right.
Yeah. So those are three positions on this. The other two positions have to do with when you're valuing both assertiveness and cooperativeness. One of those positions is compromising, when you're sort of in the middle on both of those. The other one is when you've got both turned up all the way, which would be collaborating. If competing was win-lose, collaborating would be what we call win-win. Now, collaborating is a beautiful situation because when we come out of it, collaborating brings us the most buy-in from people because everybody gets what they want. The downside is, and if you've ever tried to cultivate this, you know this, it takes a lot of time. It's messy. And sometimes we don't have that time and attention. In that case, it might be good to compromise, where people still get something that they want. They still buy in, but it's not everything.
Or maybe we compromise to buy ourselves that time.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have to come up with a solution today, but it can be a solution that we can continue to work on.
That's a great example. Yeah, again, it's choosing the time or choosing the place. You know, one final thing I'll say about these different responses is, you know, Thomas Kilman tells us that compromising and collaborating are our preferences anytime we're not under stress. And that makes some sense. But when I really looked into this, I was discouraged to find how he describes or operationalizes stress. To me, it sounded like any given Thursday. When relationships are on the line or resources are tight or you're feeling pressure.
Yeah, is that not the case?
Exactly. And
Under
that situation, you're going to naturally respond in one of those three, competing, avoiding, or accommodating. And so as you're listening to this and kind of auditing your own behavior, my encouragement to you is to think about these things as tools in your toolbox. Do you have all these tools in your toolbox? And you may find that one or more is missing, so you may need to adjust those dials accordingly. Or you may find that you have them all in your toolbox, but you're not choosing them intentionally to serve you in any given situation.
And you're not being intentional about when to use what.
Right.
We do have an online question, and it is there a way to test for this during the interview process? As in, is there a good way to tell if one of these dials would be turned up or down way more than any of the other responses?
Well, there are a variety of tests for sort of your preferred conflict styles. I would turn your attention to something called the TKI. It's a real quick inventory that lets you see kind of your preferences on this. But I do want to offer one caveat to that. While this is a great conversation tool, it provides some real insight for people into their own behavior and can make for a very productive coaching interaction if you're working with your supervisees or colleagues. It's dangerous to think of it as a diagnostic tool. I'd be very hesitant, unless you have a lot of experience with these sorts of things, to use it to create formal decisions about hiring, because after all, even if we have certain preferences or tendencies, we are more than that. We're the people that manage those things, and you don't want to rule that out.
And I would think some behavioral questions, tell me about a time when something and see what the response was there, might be a better way to go at it than an assessment.
Yeah, because you want to hear what somebody's done in a situation that was conflicting, but also you want to see if they can easily come up with situations that involve conflict, if this is visible and apparent to them at all.
Well, one of the questions I would sometimes ask in an interview is tell me about the most serious conflict you've had at work in the last 5 years, and then tell me how you handled it.
And
you get some interesting responses.
Yeah, very much so.
It is.
Well, and honestly, the biggest challenge I see in the teams and I work with or the leaders I work with is it's not necessarily how conflict was dealt with, but that there isn't any of it. Now, granted, that has to do with how they're handling it.
Exactly.
But if they can't come up with a conflict in the last 5 years, that should prompt a number of follow-up questions.
Exactly. Yeah. We have another online question. What's an example of using avoidance as the best tool in a situation? When should I just walk away and not engage?
Yeah, I would come back to that sort of idea when you know you've lost, or let me put it this way, when you know the victory will be too expensive. There is there's a term in our vocabulary these days called a Pyrrhic victory. That term actually comes from a story about a Roman general named Pyrrhus that laid siege to a city, and as he sent his troops against the city, the defenders killed them. And of course, some of the defenders died as well, but Pyrrhus had the opportunity to bring in more reinforcements, so he did. And he sent them against the city. And again, they were killed with some attrition from the defenders. And he did this multiple times until inexorably the city did eventually fall. And he marched in to declare this glorious victory. But as he did so, he had to walk through the piles and piles of casualties. And we still use the term Pyrrhic victory to describe a victory that isn't worth the cost. And if you're a leader that is faced with, you know, challenges that are going to require great exertion on your part, your team, your resources, this is
to the exclusion of everything else that needs to get done.
Absolutely. You need to keep this in mind so that you can genuinely celebrate victories. If you don't know how to avoid things, you may find yourself presiding over only Pyrrhic victories.
There's some situations where, listen, just let's take a break. I know when I used to get into serious conflict, sometimes I would just walk out of the building and take a walk down the street. You sort of think things out, and you come back and you approach things in a more constructive way.
Absolutely.
With less emotion. And so sometimes it's temporary avoidance that gets you to a point where you can maturely handle something that you might have been too emotionally engaged in.
I think we rule out that sort of pause at our expense regularly, because when we're in the middle of a difficult conversation or a conflict and emotionally things are flaring up, we're not in our right minds or prepared to do this well, we very frequently charge forward anyway. Because for some reason we rule out the option of saying, you know, I don't know if this is the best time, or, you know, this is important, and I know it's difficult, but it's too important to do it right now. Let's just take a moment. So I think that's really good advice.
Yeah. Absolutely. So let's talk about, then, we've talked about those five styles. I want to go back and talk a little bit about putting conflict in its right place, because we skipped over that, and I think it's an important concept.
Sure. At least when I use that term, I'm trying to distinguish the fact that interpersonal conflict, the kind of just person-to-person bickering that we all fear, is never really productive. And often we find ourselves in that situation Not because we lack verbal skills or the ability to face somebody, it's because we literally are thinking of this conflict as between the two of us. And so often I share with people a different mental model. This is kind of visual, so it may be tricky for a conference call, but if you envision conflict with somebody as having only two elements, you and the other person, and conflict arises between you, it's unlikely that this will ever be anything other than a head-to-head sort of difficulty.
What we call a personality difference or something.
Yeah, exactly. And so what I encourage people to do is add an element to that system, literally to add something I call the third thing. Because when you add a third
thing. That's highly technical term.
Yes, very, very technical, deeply researched. If you add a third thing to this, it doesn't just multiply the number of things in the system. It fundamentally alters the relationship between the first two. Let me give you an example that I think you probably relate to, whether you've been in this situation at work or maybe even in your personal life. If you've ever been in the situation where someone has not lived up to a particular standard, they haven't accomplished what they were asked to do or achieved the expectation, and it's your role to go address this, then you know this experience. You go and you confront them about this, and inevitably conflict arises between the two of you, right? But in the situation that I just described, really, when you think about it, is the conflict between the two of you? I don't think so. I think the conflict is really between their behavior and the standard. It's just that I'm pointing at
that. I'm the one that's bringing it to
you. Exactly. I'm conveying that. Yeah, don't shoot the messenger, right? Well, often we can't assume the role of a messenger because we've only thought of this as having two elements, the messenger and the message receiver. What I'm suggesting is you add a third thing. In this example I'm using, I would say the third thing is the standard. And what I want to do is put the conflict in the right place and help them understand that I don't have a problem with them. I'm drawing their attention to an issue between them and the standard. Now, I'm not suggesting that if you can get the conflict in the right place, you know, the birds sing, the clouds part, and everything goes perfectly. But I am saying that if, in cases like this, if you don't get the conflict in the right place, you're doomed from the start.
Well, you risk damaging the relationship, and if you get conflict in the right place, then the relationship can remain intact, even though
absolutely.
I may not really like it that you brought it to me. There's some truth to it, if I'm honest
yeah.
with myself, and look at the conflict being with the standard.
Well, you mentioned this earlier. I think this is a good example of how we turn potential combat into something that looks like mutual problem solving.
Right.
Because if there is a third thing, I can reorient this. Now, to be honest, I've drawn a triangle on a piece of paper or a napkin, or I've moved things on my desk to illustrate this. I've found this is so visual, it's important to show people this. But I've also done it verbally, where I'll say things to them like, see if you can hear in this my attempt to relocate this. Well, I don't have a personal problem with you. I'm just drawing your attention to the fact that you said you'd turn this report in by Tuesday, and we haven't received it yet. Or, I didn't get out of bed this morning to give you a hard time, but it's my role to communicate the fact that what you said you'd do, you didn't do.
Right.
Do you hear how I'm first saying it's not personal, but then I'm putting the conflict where it belongs? And if all goes well in that situation, well, one of two things is going to happen, that this makes the standard the issue. So in talking about it, either we find out that the standard wasn't clear, which, you know, that's productive. I'll admit to you that in the middle of this, that's a really uncomfortable thing to find out. But it's productive.
Right.
It's not bickering and devolving. It's productive.
Well, then there's your joint contribution.
There you go.
You know? We have something to work with.
We'll back up. We'll do that, and we'll move forward. Now, that's the first thing that could happen. But the second thing that happens when you get in the right place and the standard gets bigger is that maybe they come to the conclusion that there's indeed a problem with their behavior in the standard. And that's what you wanted all along. So you work on it together.
And I like the language, because if someone comes to me and says, you know, whatever, this is not personal, immediately I know it's going to be personal.
So yeah.
If I can avoid saying that and come at it from a this is a standard or a policy or whatever
yeah.
issue that we're
yeah.
dealing with, and let's work on it together, it's a whole different ballgame.
Well, and I, just in conclusion on that, I'd say that's the challenge for us. If you get this idea, or it's intriguing to think of a third thing, then what really is challenging is identifying a third thing.
Mm-hmm. That can be the question. That can be the first question. What's the third thing?
Well, it could be, or any time there's a standard involved, or a ground rules, a document, a vision, those things are all third things in waiting. They're always there for us to
right.
reference, because that's where the power in our leadership should come from. But there's all sorts of other times that you might invoke a third thing. I'll use this example as I was talking to my son one time about the fact that he hadn't followed through on something he was supposed to do. And I could have told him, hey, let me tell you what's wrong with you. But I tried to invoke a third thing. I said, hey, Zach, I know that you want to be the kind of person that everybody can rely on and that they're sure and certain of. And I just want to let you know that when you don't follow through like that, it's the sort of thing that could cause them not to think that. So the third thing in this
yeah.
wasn't my opinion. The third thing was I'm invoking what he wants to be. And as a good father or a leader, I'm drawing his attention to the effect of this so that I'm not the enemy. And in fact, in that occasion, it was successful. We had a great discussion about integrity and what that means. And I figure if you can pull that off with a 14-year-old boy, surely this has other implications, right?
Exactly. Okay, *7 to talk, or enter your question in the Q&A box and hit send. We're waiting for your question.
Another thought that was going through my mind before, anytime you're in these conflict situations, sometimes trying to find out what other people are thinking, why they're thinking that way.
Right. So, that's the curiosity.
What went into your conclusion that the sky is blue, and sort of probe about how they got to that point. And sometimes you all of a sudden, well, now I understand what that person's position is. And sometimes that brings you closer to compromise.
Right. And it's important in asking it the right way.
Yes.
Not, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
Why seems intimidating, because it's almost like you're accusing me of doing something wrong. So I think language is so important.
Yeah,
in all of this.
But I love that you're highlighting the value of questions.
Yeah.
Because in conflict, leading in the interrogatory mode is so important. And, you know, question marks will save you from a lot of other problems. Now, Mary makes a good point. It's not like, you know, what kind of idiot are you? You know, that's not what we're talking about. But a genuine question.
Yeah.
Does two things that's really valuable in conflict. Number one, it signals that you're not adversarial, you know, because it's not ending with a period or an exclamation point that prompts greater conflict. And number two, it doesn't give anybody the opportunity to just hunker down and take it or to back away.
Right.
When you ask a genuine question, it requires that they step towards it, they engage. And that's what we're looking for in a productive conversation.
And most, when you're asking people why, they tend to want to defend what they've done and explain how
exactly.
They reached the conclusion.
Exactly.
And sometimes that's very enlightening to your position, too.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, another thought I was having here, with any of these conversations, it's very important to stick with the facts and not, I remember a long time ago, I criticized somebody for having a bad attitude, but that's just a baloney criticism, because it's that attitude is so
subjective.
Nebulous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Whereas if you say, well, yesterday you hollered at somebody, and that indicates that you have a, you know, get
yeah.
specific about things and stick to the facts.
Yeah, good
and
point.
And stay away from emotional, stay away from vague descriptions of anything.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, whenever you start, it comes back to that fundamental attribution error that, you know, we may see a lot of evidence, but when we start connecting those dots and making assertions
yeah.
about other people's intentions and attitudes,
yeah.
we are wrong more often than not.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have another online question, and that this person is asking for suggestions to handle the avoidance response when it comes from a superior. In other words, when I'm on the receiving end of it.
When you mean when someone is avoiding you?
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you want to know how to pick a fight. Is that
right? when your boss is avoiding a conflict?
Right, when the boss is the avoider.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think in sort of broad terms here, and maybe somebody even in the room has a more specific example, but in broad terms, I think that most people avoid conflict when it's inappropriate, because that's either the one tool in their toolbox and they're just used to that, or because they don't see what the conflict could bring positively.
Mm-hmm.
So typically, it's not that I would fault the response as much as I would turn my attention to somehow illuminating what is to be gained by conflict. Because, like, having conflict is hard. It takes effort, it takes emotion, it takes the vulnerability. So it's sometimes difficult. And before we step into anything difficult, we do the calculus to decide, is the return worth this investment? And so in global terms, I'd say the main issue is to maybe help your supervisor appreciate what the returns could be in ways that merit the difficulty and vulnerability that come from engaging.
I'll go a little bit different step there. I would approach the boss maybe in writing or maybe in conversation and say, listen, I really want to talk to you about XYZ subject. When can we schedule a time to talk
right.
about it?
Mm-hmm.
So give
right.
that person time to get their thoughts together.
It's not confrontational.
Yeah, and in the meantime, you get your thoughts. Make sure you get all your facts together and not emotions.
Yeah.
But bosses should not be avoiding conflict if it's a serious issue. And,
right.
And it's up to you, if you're a leader, to push that issue politely and you know, time may be an issue too. You don't want to push it too quickly.
Exactly.
Well, and I think sometimes people don't appreciate that when you avoid conflict, it doesn't go away. Sometimes I phrase it like this, that when you put conflict away, you know, you shove it under the table, avoid and all that. You don't resolve it. You just give up your opportunity to manage it.
Right.
So really you're placing yourself in vulnerability to it. And it may be the sort of thing that it may also need to be apparent that avoiding this doesn't make it go away. It actually is coming back to haunt that leader. And maybe they need to see that not as another isolated event, but actually the natural consequence of their avoidance.
One more question.
Okay, that's it.
Can you give a business example of a Pyrrhic victory?
Oh, well, I can give an example of a Pyrrhic victory from my own life, my own business. Maybe not a classic case study in this situation. I see Joe scratching his head here.
I'm trying to think of why.
Well, I'll keep talking and buy you some time. At one point, my subordinates put a cartoon on my desk over the weekend. I came in and found this little, like, Far Side cartoon. It was the picture of the prow of a large ship just barely sticking up out of the water. And the captain was standing on the railing and pulling up on it with all his might. And you could just barely see the word Titanic written on it. And he was saying, just a minute, I've almost got it. And I realized that this was sort of a veiled critique because it was difficult for me to let go. I'm a competitive person, and we had a situation where we were trying to move a very important program forward. It had begun to cost a lot of money. We had run into a lot of problems. And instead of reassessing, instead of thinking about whether this was worth it or whether to charge forward was going to be beneficial, I stayed locked on execution. Now, there are other times that this defines leaders, that they are not easily detracted from what they were doing. But in my case, my conflict response to these things was to compete instinctively and without pausing to slow my roll, without having avoidance in my repertoire, I just kept hammering away with my one tool. And in the end, we did accomplish this, and we had a great program. But to be honest, it beat people up. It cost a lot of money. And I really believe that one major transition among my people came from that experience where I just didn't pay attention, and it was like I was going to, you know, ride this horse to the end, even if it killed the horse.
And I had a similar experience with a client who was insistent on staying with a project that was way overfunded by the end of it. Had driven lots of people away, was killing the ones that were left, and still they wouldn't give it up until a year later when someone else came in and made them give it up. So,
Great example. Okay. I hope that is an isolated experience in my leadership, but unfortunately it's a pretty good example of a Pyrrhic victory.
Exactly.
Okay, folks, I think we've come to the end of our time here. Andrew Johnston, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a great discussion. Hope you all have gotten a lot out of it. Mary, thanks for everything. Tom, William, and we'll look forward to seeing you next month. That would be on
May 9th.
And we're going to talk about the Work Institute and about employee engagement. Danny Nelms is going to be our guest. So we'll see you on May 9th. Adios, everybody.